This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, I'm Craig Norris, and I want to invite you to check out the R330. It's kind of like Quirks and Quarks, except I don't talk about space or science or anything like that. Instead, I play the week's best Canadian indie music. Head over to cbcradio3.com for all of the info.
Hello, I'm Stuart McLean, and this is The Vinyl Cafe. Well, here it is. The year has hardly begun, and I am at loose ends. To be honest, a complete loss. Somehow, somewhere, sometime since I went to bed last night and rose this morning, my to-do list went missing. Now, I know what you're thinking. I misplaced it, but I don't think that. I wouldn't misplace something as important as my to-do list. I suspect it was tidied up. It was written in dark blue ink on a piece of yellow-lined paper, and when I say it, I don't want you to think there was only one item on my list and I should be able to remember it. There was way more than one item. I'm a busy man. I can't possibly remember everything on the list. That's why I had the list. Yes, I know I'm always putting my glasses down somewhere that I can't remember, but this is different. This is my list of things to do. And no, I don't remember where I was when I had it last. Please don't ask me that again. And now I don't know what I am meant to be doing. And it's making me agitated. Are you sure you haven't seen it? Let me tell you what it looks like. There was actually more than one list. There were several lists, each in a different quadrant of the page. Things to do, people to write, people to call. And there was a little doodle in the top right corner, a picture of a hammer smashing a little animal that you might mistake for a squirrel, but it's actually the neighbor's dog. It wouldn't stop yapping when I was working on my list. I keep thinking of the people on my list. Were you on my list? I'd like to take this opportunity to apologize. I haven't forgotten you. I lost my list. Are you someone sitting in a coffee shop waiting for me? Are you a dentist standing beside an empty dentist chair, dentist tools laid out beside you? I'm not coming. If there's a paucity of me where you are, and there shouldn't be, if there should be more of me than there is, it's not personal. You might have heard already, I lost my list of things to do. I want to assure you that I'm going to begin a new list. I have already, actually. But you aren't on it yet. So far, there's only one item on my new list. Number one, find missing to-do list, which is why I'm talking to you now. If by any chance you have my to-do list, could you please call me? If you don't have my number, you could phone any of the numbers on the list and ask them for my number. Tell them I said it was okay to give it to you. I'll come over and pick the list up. It suddenly occurs to me that someone other than you might have the list. Was I supposed to call you today? Has someone else already called? Have you received any confusing phone calls? It's possible my list has fallen into the hands of one of those people who like to get things done. One of those people who, unlike you and me, actually enjoys sitting down and crossing things off lists. Don't ask me how. Maybe the person who threw away my list, either by mistake or out of spite because of a little thing that I've already apologized for, so I don't see why we need to get into that right now. Maybe when they got rid of it, they were careless about it and it ended up with one of those compulsive list-completing types. Maybe someone like that found my list in their pocket, and no, I don't have any idea how it got there. But if it's possible to send a man to the moon, surely it's not impossible that somehow my list ended up in their coat. And if they're one of those people who like getting things done, maybe they were delighted to reach into their pocket and find my list with all those things just begging to be crossed off. If you are the person who has my list and are getting my things done, I appreciate that, but I'd appreciate it more if you just return my list to me. Because you aren't doing those things for me, you're doing them for yourself. And you should get your own list. I'm beginning to feel unhinged without mine. And though I understand how you may be feeling pretty smug getting all those things done, have you stopped to think what it's like being me, not having the vaguest idea of what you're supposed to be doing? Just give it back to me. I live in the house with all the windows beside the one with a little yappy dog that's starting to drive me crazy. Honest to God, when are they going to take that dog inside and feed it? Where is my list? I want my list back. You can have my glasses and my keys and my cell phone and all the other things I've lost. Just give me the list, and then you can do whatever you want to the dog. I'll look after the dog right now if you'll just give me my list. Listen, this can't continue. Do you know what would happen if I don't do the things I'm supposed to do? If I stop calling and writing and showing up? If I unplug? You don't have to answer that. Okay, I warned you, I'm over it now. It's gone. Do what you want with it. I don't need it anymore. I'm done with to-do lists. I'm beginning again. I'm starting fresh. I'm going upstairs to write out a list of things I don't have to do. You can have my to-do list. I'm starting my to-don't list, and I don't care what happens to it. This is Human Highway. Human Highway with their song All Day. Human Highway is Jim Guthrie and Nick Thorburn, both originally from Guelph, Ontario. They took their name from the Neil Young song, which goes quite nicely with the title of their debut album, Moody Motorcycle. I'd like to read you a letter that came into the Vinyl Cafe mailbox over the holidays. I hope you like it as much as I do. Came from Dan Leonard of Winnipeg, Manitoba. Dear Stuart, writes Dan, recently I married a Canadian. Her name is Karen. Now, I know for many of your listeners, marrying a Canadian is no big deal, but since I'm from the States, and from Philadelphia in particular, this has proven to be a larger cultural shift than I expected. In the East Coast, growing up 2 hours from New York and 2 hours from Washington, D.C., you can get the sense that you're living in the center of the world. Karen, on the other hand, is from Winnipeg. And though Winnipeggers are quick to remind you that they are at the geographic center of Canada, it's still a far cry from the center of the world. When we started dating, I worked for an international nonprofit organization, in a job that often took me to intense locations, places such as Colombia, the Congo, and the Middle East, and, well, visiting Winnipeg always felt too distant or out of touch or maybe just too quaint, given the intensity that I was used to. Karen is potentially the most passionate Winnipeg lover in the entire city. She sees the beauty in the prairies, in the open landscape, in the big skies, and, yes, somehow, even in the cold. She's also quick to see the beauty in people and neighbors and things like gardening or having drinks with friends. Karen and I met when I was visiting Winnipeg for a meeting. She was working at the Mennonite University where our meetings were being held. In the middle of one of those meetings involving intense topics like war and conflict resolution in Colombia, Karen came stumbling into our meeting room, realized we were all there, nervously apologized repeatedly, giggled uncontrollably, and then left. It wasn't exactly graceful, but it sure was cute. I wrote on my notes, "She's cute," and passed it to the coworker beside me. Later, I passed her in the hallway when she was going into the washroom. I quickly started a conversation with someone else right outside the washroom in hopes of bumping into her on her way out of the washroom. It sort of worked, though it was anything but smooth and, in retrospect, was really kind of weird. We ended up talking anyway. Then she, being the Winnipeg advocate that she is, offered to take the out-of-towner out to see the city. We had a great evening of laughter and stories, all of which continued after I left Winnipeg. Our relationship continued, and on a cold winter day last February, while walking on the frozen Assiniboine River, I asked Karen to marry me. It was a beautiful moment. But the months that followed, the months leading up to our wedding, were anything but beautiful. Hardly a day passed when we didn't wonder out loud whether we were making a terrible decision. It was hard and anxiety-making. Often our conversations had to do with my desire not to live in Winnipeg and her desire never to leave. Then you came to Winnipeg. And you told the story of Pollock's Hardware Store and how, faced with its closing, the community had rallied, bought shares, and turned it into a co-op. Karen and I were in her kitchen at the time listening to this story, and although I'm an Irish Catholic, a breed which has chosen to more often drink than cry, I looked up and realized that both Karen and I had tears in our eyes. The story was beautiful, and in some sort of epiphany, I finally was able to see the beauty of Winnipeg. And at risk of being overly dramatic, I think I finally understood Karen. This past August, Karen and I got married in Winnipeg. It was a joyous event, a Mennonite and a Catholic getting married, though I'm not sure our marriage has exactly canceled out the Reformation. As for me, well, I'm learning how to love those immediate things, to love my neighbors, to love Winnipeg and all its subtlety, to love Karen, and yes, to even love the cold. Well, maybe that's a stretch, but I think I'm learning to tolerate it. You said in your Winnipeg show that Winnipeg's the hardest place to move to and the hardest place to leave. I think this is true, and I'm probably somewhere between the two at the moment. My biggest fear now is that we will never leave. Increasingly, this is not even a fear, but an excitement. Canada isn't so bad after all. So, thanks for your story, Stuart, and for telling stories that bring laughter and sadness together in some beautiful way. Mary Oliver once said, "Stories are more beautiful than answers." So thanks for telling us stories. They have, oddly enough, even helped our marriage, as we've learned to love each other's stories. I'm sure you get lots of requests like this, so please forgive me for adding to it, but I wonder if we sent you a book or bought a new book, if you'd maybe be willing to sign it. I think we'd like to keep it around our home, maybe as a family heirloom to remind us of the things that we have learned in the beginning of our marriage. Thanks for considering this, and all the best to you and the crew at the Vinyl Cafe. Warmly, Dan. It's a lovely letter, one of the many lovely letters we get regularly here at the show. And Dan, I'd be delighted to send you and Karen a book. In fact, I'd like to do one better than that. We're coming to Manitoba at the beginning of February. We're going to be in Minnedosa, Manitoba on February 1st and 2nd. And Minnedosa is not that far from Winnipeg. I'd love to have you and Karen as my guests at that show. I'll be in touch and maybe we can set that up. And in the meantime, I'll send you a book in the mail on me. Consider it a wedding present. And this today to you and Karen, this is the Winnipeg group, and I should add Winnipeg couple, who call themselves The Land, with their song, I Believe.
I Believe.
Was Judith Klassen and Simon Neufeld, a Winnipeg couple who call themselves The Land. Time now for the Vinyl Cafe Story Exchange. Well, you know how this works. This is the part of the show where you send us your stories. They have to be true and they have to be short, but after that, it's up to you. We have one today from Harley Hay of Red Deer, Alberta. Dear Stuart, writes Harley, every once in a while I like to dig out my old class pictures. I have a laugh at hairdos, shake my head at how things have changed since, and grow quiet the way you do when those long-ago images of elementary school take you back into the swirling, misty moments of the past. Grade 3. South School. I walk to South School every day, across the old wooden footbridge over the trickling Wascasu Creek. Often, I would walk with Glenn. Glenn lived in a broken-down house, more of a shack, really, just down the street from me. If the timing was right, we'd join in on our way to school, kicking rocks down the sidewalk in the fall, throwing the odd snowball in the winter, and floating little matchstick boats down the gutter rivulets in the spring. We never said much to each other. Glenn wasn't much for words. He'd been held back a grade or two in school, and he was much taller and bigger than the rest of the grade threes. He always seemed to me to be a bit embarrassed, maybe, scrunching in the little desk in Mrs. Lougheed's class. But everyone liked Glenn, and everyone liked his dog, Blackie. Blackie was a big old black lab, as quiet and gentle as Glenn himself. Outside of school, the two were never apart. Often, Blackie would walk Glenn and me to school and then make his way back home by himself. And often, Blackie would be there all by himself at the end of the school day, waiting to walk us home again. Time spent with Blackie was Glenn's favorite time. Mine, too. Blackie wasn't supposed to be at the school, though. Glenn's mum had been told that dogs weren't allowed in the school grounds, and Blackie didn't have a license or even a collar, for that matter. There had been a couple of incidents with dogs biting kids at the school, but we all knew that Blackie would never bother anybody. One spring day, the recess bell rang, and I looked out the classroom window and saw Blackie sitting in the schoolyard. He was sitting in the shade by the baseball diamond. He had heard the bell, too, and that big old tail had started to wag because he knew Glenn would soon be there. When the bell rang, we all ran out of the classroom to the yard. Glenn made a beeline straight for Blackie, with me right behind him. We were both instantly rewarded with a woof and a lick, but Glenn was worried. He told Blackie to go home, that he wasn't supposed to be there, that he would get in trouble. Glenn never raised his voice. He just told Blackie very serious-like, and Blackie knew he was in trouble. But Blackie wasn't going anywhere. By this time, most of our grade 3 class had gravitated over to see Blackie, everyone kneeling down for a hug, hoping for a lick. The most popular girl in grade 3, Penny Bond, was on the receiving end of a mighty slurp when we heard the sound of wheels on gravel. The van pulled up right beside us. It was the dog catcher. "I have to take the dog," said the dog catcher as he got out of the van. He was carrying a pole with a loop of rope on it. It looked like a noose to me. Nobody moved. Blackie woofed. Glenn kneeled beside Blackie, hugging him. "He's my dog," said Glenn. "It's okay, he's my dog. He's Blackie." The dog catcher took a step towards us, slowly swinging his pole. "I don't see a license on this animal. He doesn't even have a collar. I have to take him to the pound, kid. If he's your dog, you can claim him, pay the fee, and take him home." Glenn was trying really hard not to cry in front of all of his friends. He didn't want to say that his mom didn't have the money to get Blackie out of the pound. He didn't want to say that if you take Blackie now, nobody'll come and get him from the pound. He didn't want to say it, but we all knew what happened to dogs that nobody claimed from the pound. The dog catcher wasn't listening. He took another step toward Blackie, and Glenn started to cry, and suddenly, somehow, we all stood in front of Glenn and Blackie. We stood in between them, between Blackie and the dog catcher, and then Penny Bond grabbed my hand, and I grabbed someone else's hand, and we all linked hands together, forming a circle, a huge circle of grade three kids, arms outstretched, building a human fence around our friend and his dog. It was one of those moments where you just know you'll always remember it, even when you're old, especially when you're old. So we stood there, Glenn and Blackie in the middle of our circle, the dog catcher outside, not exactly sure what to do next. Nobody said a word. We would have stood there forever if it wasn't for Mrs. Lougheed. Somehow, she appeared out the back door of the school and called the dog catcher, and they stood over by his ugly orange dog catcher van, and although we couldn't hear what they were saying, we could see that they were having more than just your everyday, normal, boring adult-type conversation. We hung onto our circle even harder now. And then, something amazing happened. The dog catcher got into his van and drove off. He didn't say anything to us at all. He didn't even look over at us. He just drove away. When all the cheering and hugging and crying died down, Mrs. Lougheed got us all settled back down in the classroom. Blackie sprawled in the corner at the back of the room, snoozing away contentedly for the rest of the afternoon. I had never seen Glenn so happy. Blackie never came on the school grounds again. He would wait for Glenn on the boulevard across the street in the shade. Blackie was smart that way. Glenn and his dog and his mom moved away that summer, and I never saw them again. But every now and then I take out my old cardboard box of memories and pull out my grade three class picture. If you look closely, there with all the silly smiles and goofy hairdos of the proud and shiny 8-year-olds, there's an old black dog curled up at the feet of the biggest kid in the class. That story came to us from Harley Hay of Red Deer, Alberta. This is Katie Moore with My Old Dog. Try chase them away.
me when I'm wrong. With you, with me, I'll never lose my song. My old dog keeps me
That was Montreal musician Katie Moore with her song, My Old Dog. And you can find that song on Katie Moore's album called Only Thing Worse. Well, it's been a cold and blustery winter where I live. By all accounts, that pretty much sums up what it's been like in the rest of the country, or the parts I've been reading about anyway. This is not news, I know. It's supposed to be cold and blustery at this time of year. It's just that this year seems to be blustier than most. There have been over the years many attempts to get down on paper the essence of a Canadian winter. I think of the opening paragraphs of Hugh MacLennan's quintessential Canadian novel, Two Solitudes, and his poetic description of Montreal's Sherbrooke Street on a snowy winter night. I think of William Kurelek's sunny prairie paintings, of David Blackwood's dark etchings of the great Newfoundland sealing disaster of 1914. They all get part of it. They all come close to it in their own way. But I would like to put forward none of them get closer to the heart of the matter, closer to the bone-numbing chill of a January wind, than Robert W. Service, the Bard of the Yukon himself, gets in that most famous of his poems, The Cremation of Sam McGee. Well, you know how it goes. There are strange things done in the midnight sun by the men who moil for gold. The Arctic trails have their secret tales that would make your blood run cold. The northern lights have seen queer sights, but the queerest they ever did see was that night on the marge of Lake LaBarge. I cremated Sam McGee. Now that's what I call poetry, an epic chiller about the night Sam McGee froze to death on the Klondike Trail and then sprung back to life for a moment on his funeral pyre. It begins thus. Sam McGee was from Tennessee, where the cotton blooms and blows. Well, guess what? That's not even close to being true. Not at all. Sam McGee was actually from Peterborough, Ontario. Well, Lindsay, to be precise. I know this. I have been to his grave, and I have spoken to a number of his descendants. I met one of them at a recent Vinyl Cafe concert, his granddaughter, I think. William Sam McGee. Does it surprise you to learn that McGee was not a figment of Service's overblown imagination? Well, he wasn't. He was born in 1867. Irish parents, was a prospector, a sourdough in and around Whitehorse. McGee had a bank account at the Canadian Bank of Commerce in Whitehorse, where young Robert Service worked as a teller. That's right, teller. Many of Service's readers believed he was a hard-boiled Klondike prospector. He was a bank teller, and he lived until 1958. He saw McGee's name on the bank ledger and pilfered it for his poem. Sam McGee might have moiled for gold, but he didn't expire in a snowstorm on the edge of Lake LaBarge. He died of a stroke, I think, on his daughter's farm not far from Calgary. I thought it was high time someone set the record straight. If you would permit me, then, the cremation of Sam McGee, the sequel, the poem Service meant to write, would surely have written had he made it to Sequelville. I present it today with a nod to this winter and deep apologies to all concerned. There are strange things done neath the midnight sun by bank tellers who work in the cold. The Arctic banks have their secret ranks of writers and poets, I'm told. The Northern Lights have seen queer sights, but the queerest they ever did see was the night on the marge of Lake LaBarge I created Sam McGee. Now, Sam McGee weren't from Tennessee. That was just a writer's trick. And when I think today of what he had to say in my poem, it makes me feel sick. I took his name, if it's all the same, from a list on my desk at the bank. It's what writers do when they're brewing a stew to stop it from getting too rank. Well, he came in one day and I said, "Hey, I hope you don't mind what I wrote." And he turned to me and "Bob," says he, as he reached out and grabbed at my throat. "It's been 30 long years and we have some arrears to settle between us two. So listen up well, 'cause my life has been hell and I've been feeling mighty blue. I'm from Lindsay, you see, not from Tennessee, and I'm still living, I guess you could say. I lit out from home when I was barely a gnome, 15 years if I was a day. I've been traveling around, but I've come back to town 'cause I'm feeling so poorly and lame. And I see by the door at the general store they're already selling my last remains." Well, he plunked a jug down, and I stared with a frown as the ashes spilled out on my desk. And he let my throat go and said, "I want you to know I've come to you with my dying request." Well, he seemed so low that I couldn't say no. Then he began with a moaning sound and said, "When I'm gone and it's time to move on, I want to be put in the ground." Well, a man's last need is a thing to heed, and I swore I would not fail. He said it's the fear of the fire drawing near that was making his skin so pale. I said it's just a poem that I wrote coming home from a party a long time ago. And he said through the tears of 30 long years, "You doomed me to burn when I go." He crouched by my desk and raved for the rest of the night of his fear of the fire. I said, "Those ashes you bought, it's a tourist shop. Don't make a small thing so dire. You ain't yet dead," I said, shaking my head, and he laughed and he started to glow. "It's the fevers," he said. "Get me a bed. I want clean sheets when I go." For a day and a night he kept up the fight as he sweated his life away. A fever so hot that, believe it or not, he singed the sheets the next day. And at dawn on the third, I give you my word, all that was left to see was a small pile of dust, and I knew it was just what remained of Sam McGee. There are strange things done neath the midnight sun by bank tellers who work in the cold. The Arctic banks have their secret ranks of writers and poets, I'm told. The Northern Lights have seen queer sights, but the queerest they ever did see was that night on the marge of Lake LaBarge I created Sam McGee. Well, that's just about all the time we have for today's show. Before we go, I should tell you some Vinyl Cafe concerts we have coming up in a few weeks. Earlier in the show, I told you about a couple of shows we have coming up in Minnedosa, Manitoba. Those shows are on February 1st and 2nd. After that, we're going to head home, do our laundry, and then we're heading out again, heading east to Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, Prince Edward Island, and wait for it now, to Maine. We'll be making stops in Charlottetown, Summerside, Miramichi, Fredericton, St. John, Moncton, Port Hawkesbury, Glace Bay, Truro, Wolfville, Halifax, and Orono and Portland, Maine. That's in February and March. We'd love to see you at one of those shows if you live in the area. You can check out the dates and pick up tickets on the Vinyl Cafe website. That's vinylcafe.com. In the meantime, we'll be back here, same time, same place, next week with another brand new show. Thanks this week to Anton Szabo for the technical assistance. David Amer is the founding producer of The Vinyl Cafe. Louise Curtis is the production assistant. Julie Penner is the music producer. Meg Masters is the long-suffering story editor. The Vinyl Cafe is produced by Jess Milton. I'm Stuart McLean. So long for now.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.